You're listening to
Fresh Ideas for Teaching.
Hi, everyone. This is Walter Rodriguez. You're listening to the Fresh Ideas for Teaching podcast. I'm here with my colleague, Jamie Downey, director on the K-5 MyView Literacy Solution. Jamie, who's our special guest today?
Thanks, Walter. I'm honored to have Dr. Frank Serafini on the show today to launch our Learning to Read What Really Matters series. Dr. Serafini is an author, illustrator, photographer, educator, musician, and professor of literacy education and children's literature in the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College at Arizona State University. In addition to being an award-winning children's book author and illustrator, Frank was an elementary school teacher and literacy specialist for 12 years. Recently, Frank was awarded the 2019 ILA Dina Fiedelstein Research Award. We are honored that Dr. Serafini is an author on MyView Literacy, our newest K-5 literacy solution. Dr. Serafini, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on. It sounds like an exciting series, and I'm honored to be part of it.
So glad to have you. Dr. Serafini, you are one of the leading researchers in the area of literacy and comprehension, particularly in the areas of visual and multimodal literacy. Can you talk to us a little bit about your current research?
A lot of the research I've done stemmed out of my work with picture books and trying to understand how children made sense of the multimodal aspects of children's picture books. And from that, of course, as we move into digital platforms and digital environments, it just gets more and more complex. And so the work that I did originally in understanding picture books and in comprehension has now grown into trying to understand children making sense of image, text, and everything in between. And so I think as we progress further into the digital era, this will only become more and more important for us to understand how kids make sense of things, including text, but beyond text, right? That seems to be where we're at. So I took a look at a study on how museums were portrayed in children's picture books. Was a new one that just is coming out. I'm working on a book on methodologies for researching visual and multimodal phenomena that'll be out next year. And so, I'm just kind of trying to stay busy in these strange times.
Most definitely. And I think how interesting, looking at how children make sense of text and everything else, especially as we have shifted our focus more to digital instruction as a result of the, our current world situation. So you're still working with pre-service teachers and doctoral students who are in the classroom. How are you helping them to prepare to start a school year that looks like nothing we've ever seen?
Yeah. Luckily, I dodged the bullet this year and my undergrad course is not in the fall semester. But I have been doing webinars with teachers in Florida and throughout the Midwest for trying to understand what to do. And, I don't have a crystal ball. And what I found in talking with teachers is that every scenario is different. There's very little commonality other than people are trying to figure it out, right? That's the one common thing. One of the recommendations I made on one of the webinars I did was don't sort of get swept up in the digital app sort of bling, techno bling thing, right? And what I've tried to explain to teachers is if there are apps or technologies you think you would benefit from going forward, no matter what your setting, then use them. If you're just trying to figure out Yellow Dig or something to just do in one environment, it may not be, it's only going to be worthwhile for a month or two, hopefully, right? And so if these technologies we're looking at aren't going to help you continually, if they're not doing something for you down the road, I think try to find the ones that are, right? And so, and I also found that, as you start looking across this, we have lists and lists of different technologies available. There's a lot of them that just do the same thing. There's no magic bullet out there, right? We have technologies for seeing each other, technologies for talking to each other, technologies for writing to each other and collaborating on all those things. I think it's kind of interesting to find other ways to communicate and get involved with children. You know, I saw this great article on a math teacher who jogged through the neighborhood of where her kids lived and wrote math problems on the driveway in chalk. And the kids had to solve it and take a picture of it and send it to the teacher every night. Now, I know we can't always do that, but I thought that was incredibly creative. And I'd love to see us trying to figure out how to do this, you know, how to do other things with kids. Put them in the backyard and let them explore weird things, right? You know, I don't know. It's tough.
I definitely think, you know, we recognize the work that our medical professionals are doing, and definitely they're superheroes. And I think, you know, we all would agree that the work that our teachers are doing right now, and educators across the board, is definitely heroic. So,
I just hope that this appreciation of teachers that we see in the news continues past this pandemic, and I hope that it rolls into increasing pay, increasing the quality of teaching jobs. I'm afraid it's just everyone's complaining about lack of babysitting and not what the work teachers really do. And I hope we see some work in supporting the great teachers that we have. Yeah.
Couldn't agree more. That would definitely be a silver lining, you know, a silver lining of this pandemic if we come out of it with a long-term appreciation for the work that teachers do and really supporting them appropriately.
On the flip side too, I think this whole thing, especially since March, has exposed some bad teaching too. You know, and we've got to, if we're in the middle of the profession, we've got to turn the gaze on ourselves too. And, you know, worksheets in school are bad, but worksheets on a tablet at home are worse, right? And so I hope that teachers are taking this opportunity to rethink some of these outdated practices that weren't helping kids when they sat in the room either. So I hope we see that as well.
Great, great perspective as always. And you know, I must confess, every time I am in a conversation with you, I feel so enlightened and learned so much. And as we were preparing for this podcast, I asked you what your most valued beliefs about education are, you know, your hills worth dying for, if you will. And the thoughts you sent back about what really matters in literacy education are so impactful. I'd like to discuss them with you, if you don't mind.
Of course.
First thing you wrote was, I think it is important to recognize that, of course, we want a quality education for all students. But I think we should take this as a given. How do we educate all children, support all teachers, and that's what we really need to get at? So I want to take a moment and emphasize, as you did, all children and all teachers. And how, in your opinion and in your professional experience, how do we go about ensuring that we are truly meeting the needs of all students and all teachers?
Yeah. When I said take it as a given, I think a given is that should be our goal. I don't mean to suggest that take it as a given that we're doing it. Right,
oh, right. You most know? Definitely. Sure.
I mean, that everyone who wrote back to the notes were always talking about how do we support children who are struggling? How do we support children of color? How do we support children in poverty? And I think that's the conversation we need to have right now. Along with exposing some bad teaching, I think this has also exposed what we've called the digital divide and the lack of resources in a lot of communities. Unfortunately, as often communities of color and communities of, disenfranchised groups, right? And so as we keep the goal in our mind to increase the improve the education for all students and all things, I think one of the things that kind of goes back to the old environmental days for me, and that is kind of the think globally, act locally, that solutions in education don't scale up real well. What works really well in a New York City school might not work in an Arizona school. The magic silver bullet of one size fits all has never been attainable, right? And so I think in this time, as we're trying to ensure the quality education for all students and quality working conditions for all teachers, we have to define what we mean by equality in the local context, right? And what can we do there? And how do we support that? I also think one of the biggest things we've not done well in the teaching profession is bring parents into the conversation and community members in better ways other than telling them what we need or what they should do at home. And that was one of the opening parts on the webinar I did was, have you reached out to parents to ask them what supports they need at home rather than telling them what you need them to do, right? And this is a time where we've got to be in conversation with parents and community members, not telling them. It's a challenge. I think, you know, obviously the political field, the economic field all play into whether we have the resources to do this well. I also believe that we are in a time period of a deprofessionalization of teachers. I think that the teaching profession has been beaten up pretty good. We've had a lot of people retire during this pandemic. We've had a lot of great teachers get fed up with a variety of things. And I'm just not sure that we're attracting the best and the brightest to the profession. We want to attract people who are dedicated, but also people who are intelligent and caring and take it seriously. Right? Yeah, it's a challenge. I wish if I had the answer to that one, I'd have written that book years ago and retired. I'd be on a beach in Bora Bora right now or something, you know. But that's a great question.
So, Dr. Serafini, when we're thinking about literacy and getting kids reading, you know, of course, they have to have books. They have to have books in their hands, and they have to have good, high quality books that represent a diverse range of perspectives. How do teachers ensure that students have access to high quality texts? You know, some of them are in the classroom, some of them are not. How can teachers make sure that their students have access to a wide range of literature to keep them reading?
When I first started doing a talk called Talking with Kids About Books, I always had a subtitle that said, and other texts, right? Because it's not just books we want kids reading. And we use the term books, but I want to make sure we always think of books in the biggest, widest range, right? And so I want texts. I want high quality texts. And some of them come in book form and some of them don't, right? And so now we've got apps and we've got online reading and we've got audio books and we've got other things that people might not think of as a book, right? And so one of the ways to expand what's available is to expand the platforms in which we provide them, right? Libraries have checkout systems for tablets that you can get a lot of books. There's Project Gutenberg has all classic texts available for free. There's a lot of new things, books. I can't remember all the companies that do some of these things where you, for a fee, you can get access to a lot of digital texts, right? And I think those are important. The other thing is I know very few school libraries that are empty. You know, we got a lot of books sitting in libraries that for one reason or another, because we're worried about kids not bringing them back or some other stupid reason, aren't in the hands of kids, right? And I feel guilty. I mean, I've got a couple thousand books in my office at ASU that I use for my children's literature classes, but I feel guilty that kids aren't reading them every day. They're sitting in my office, right? And so I think one of the things is until your library is empty, there's some books that can go to a kid. Right. And so how do we get them in their hands? And I think we've got to budget in. Some books aren't coming back and just get over it. Right. And get the books. And if you have the choice between losing a book or having a kid not read, lose the book. Right. And so schools need to be really open centers where people can come in and get these texts. The other thing is in classrooms, I also think, and I'm a big, look at, I love librarians. They saved me when I was a kid. And I love school libraries because they saved me as a kid because of this horrible stuff they made me read in my classroom as a little kid. But sometimes even the school library is too far, right? I mean, when I want to read something and I can't find something to read without getting up from my seat, I've made an egregious error. You know, I did a study looking at people reading on airplanes and doctor's offices and stuff like this. And people read on airplanes who don't read anywhere else because there's nothing to do and there's something to read in within reach. And the doctor office study that I was looking up, people pick up books that are on the coffee table 10 times more frequently than walking across the room to a shelf of books. And that's just 8 feet, right? And so when we say it's time for kids to read, they shouldn't have to leave their chair to have 25 different things to read. They should be in their backpacks. They have books on their tables or books in their desks, books on something close. We can't make it hard for kids to find what we have either, right? And then we've got to teach kids how to browse. We have, you know, some kids in classrooms who would browse for a long time, never choosing. And sometimes it's because they don't know what they want. And we've got to, teachers need to become better at facilitating browsing, helping kids find something that they will engage with, not telling them what to engage with. I think we could do a better job with that.
But you talked about teachers teaching students how to browse. We've also, and you've written extensively and talked a lot about teaching kids how to talk about books.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that and the importance of students talking about books in the classroom, about texts in the classroom?
You know, if everyone says they want to create lifelong readers, and then they turn around and do stuff to kids with books that lifelong readers would never do. You know, no one ever finished a good book and said, man, I got to go find me a cardboard box so I can build a diorama. You know, I mean, this just doesn't happen. What do people do when they finish reading a book? They talk about it or they give it to somebody else. Right? This is what we do. And so in classrooms, we've got to do what lifelong readers do. We've got to provide opportunities for kids to do the same thing. They got to be able to read another book by the same person, read the same book again, talk to somebody about the book, find another book that's related to this one, change genres completely and try something totally new. But I think it was James Britton years ago said that learning floats on a sea of talk. And I've never forgotten that kind of sentiment. That if you want to teach kids stuff, other than demonstrating physically how to do something, which is there's less physical in reading than there is in playing baseball, for example. We've got to let them talk. It's mostly talk. It's talk is what our lessons come through. It's talk that demonstrates comprehension. It's talk that shows kids how to talk about books, right? And so classrooms can't be quiet places. I mean, it has to be manageable talk, right? Manage in that sense. But there's got to be a lot more of it, right? I know that Marty Nystrand years ago did some research in high school classes where there was less than 5 minutes of talk during a 45-minute hour English class of student talk, right? You know, and that's crazy. That's insane. Because if there's only 5 minutes of student talk, we know who's talking, right? That's why teachers are tired at the end of the day. They talked all day, you know? And so how do we change that around to get kids, you know? You got to tell teachers, hey, you've got your degree. You don't need to talk about the book so much. Let the kids talk, right? And I get it. I love talking about books with my students. And I'm guilty as much as anybody else of talking a lot when it happens. You know, these podcasts are great. I get to talk so much, you know. But we want to have kids talking. You know, it's not about you anymore. It's what do the kids think of the book, and let them talk and figure out how to facilitate that. And it's a challenge for a lot of teachers, facilitating a quality discussion without taking it over. Right? I think we can still have kids write about books and find other ways to respond, chat rooms. I write stuff on Goodreads from time to time and, you know, those kind of things. But for most of it, when you finish with a good book, you should be allowed to talk with somebody about it, about whether you liked it or hated it or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's hard to talk about a book you don't understand. So it's a readily accessible assessment to figure out whether kids are making sense of what they read. You know? So I think that's really, and there's all kinds of formats. There's whole group, small group, book clubs, lit study groups, one-on-one, parents at home, you know, response journals. There's a lot of ways of doing it. But the essence is thinking, responding, and thinking some more. You know? Yeah, it's good.
We talked about, you know, perhaps there being some silver linings with our current situation. As you look forward, you know, what are your hopes for literacy education?
You know, I sit on the NAEP Reading Council, who's designing the assessments going forward. And I work, you know, David Pearson and Karen Wixon brought me onto that, and some other people, to kind of expand what these assessments could be, you know, that has to be more about digital and visual and multimodal. And the future, whether we like it or not, is not going back to print books without images in them. The rise of the graphic novel, the rise of multimedia is where it's at. And if you want to be, you know, we go back to Thomas Jefferson, who says that democracy is based on an informed citizenry. If you're going to be an informed citizen, it's a high proficiency of literacy to be able to do that in the modern age. You know, we have an opportunity now to talk about, you know, media literacy, right? But isn't media literacy almost everything now? What doesn't fit under the heading of media literacy other than reading The Secret Garden again or something? Right? I mean, everything falls into the sort of multimedia world. Picture books are and graphic novels and comics are one of the last multimodal in print form. But students' lives are digital and mobile and multimodal, and literacy education has to catch up a little bit with that. That you know, just sounding out the A sound doesn't mean you're going to understand. You know, that's just a tool to get someplace, and the landscape is very different than it was 20 years ago. And I think that that makes it challenging to do the assessments. And it also makes it challenging to raise the level of proficiency beyond just minimal foundational proficiencies. It's hard to be highly proficient, highly literate in today's society. It takes some time. You have to expend some effort, right? It's not simple. So I think as long as we have things like fake news, we're going to need something called media literacy and critical media literacy and all these things. And I think that that we have to move towards some of that work across, and not just waiting until high school and college to do it either. It's almost too late. You know, we got, you know, six and seven, 8 year olds, you're talking about going back to school. They're not bombarded daily with media and other things. Of course, that's ridiculous. Yeah. How do we have those great conversations with them about what does this do? What is this doing for you and to you?
Well, Dr. Serafini, it's been incredible to speak with you today. Thank you. Thank you so, so much.
You're too kind.
Walter, back to you.
That's all the time we have for today. Many thanks to both Dr. Frank Serafini and Jamie Downey for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Fresh Ideas for Teaching podcast. Until next time. This podcast is presented by Savvis Learning Company, a next-generation learning company providing award-winning solutions for grades pre-K through 12. Visit savvis.com today. Learn with us.